Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cure Panel Talk Show. I'm Priya Menon, scientific media editor of the Cure Talk blog, joining me from India. And I welcome all of you this evening to a discussion on cancer and nutrition. Before we begin, I would like to wish everyone here a very happy 2014. This is our third episode on Cancer and Nutrition Talk Series. In our previous episode, we discussed diet and myeloma with research scientist and Zen priest, Danny Parker. Today, we are discussing nutrition and supplements during cancer treatment and beyond. We all know that cancer is a multifaceted illness with a number of potential causes. Unfortunately, there is no magic supplement regime you can embark on, either to prevent or treat cancer. However, there is sufficient evidence that certain nutrients, phytochemicals, fatty acids, hormones, and enzymes can play a major role. Finding the right combination of nutrients for an individual is a highly personal matter that should employ the advice of a health professional experienced in cancer treatment. And today we have with us Dr. Dunal Abrams. Dr. Dunal Abrams is a cancer and integrative medicine specialist at the UCSF Osher Center for Integrative Medicine at Mount Zion. Abrams provides integrative medicine consultations for cancer patients and has completed research in complementary and alternative therapies, including mind-body treatments, botanical therapies, medical use of marijuana, and traditional Chinese medicine herbal therapies. In addition to his role at the Osher Center, he is Chief of Hematology and Oncology at San Francisco General Hospital. Great to have you with us, Dr. Abrams. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on.
The co-host of today's show is Pat Killingsworth. Pat is a myeloma survivor and has authored 4 books on myeloma. He has 2 popular blogs where he writes about myeloma and cancer. Welcome to the show, Pat. We have an international panel of experts and patients joining us today. Nancy Shamana is joining us from Canada. Nancy is a 4-year myeloma survivor. She writes a column about her experiences with myeloma for the Myeloma Beacon. We also have with us Beverly McKee, also known as a breast cancer warrior. Beverly is an author, blogger, and inspirational speaker. She combines her clinical skills and personal experience with stage 3 breast cancer to deliver a message of hope, education, and inspiration to her worldwide following through social media and speaking engagements. We have with us from India, Shweta Mishra. Shweta is a biochemist and nutritionist, currently teaching diabetes, pathophysiology, and glucose biochemistry to nutritionists aspiring to be diabetes educators, and also heads the nutrition department at a hospital in India. Welcome to the show, everyone. Before I hand over to Pat, I would like to remind everyone listening that we will be addressing questions received via email from our audience at the end of the discussion. If you have a question for our expert or panel, you can press 1 on your keypad, and we will bring you live on air to ask your question. Pat will now begin with the discussion. Pat, you're live on air.
Welcome, everyone, and Doctor, thank you for taking the time to share with us tonight. Much appreciated.
Sure.
Do you have, would you like to do a little intro, or do you want us to just jump in with questions?
Well, I am Donald Abrams. I'm Chief of Oncology at San Francisco General Hospital. I've been an oncologist now for 31 years, and at the beginning of my training, suddenly AIDS came out of the blue and we didn't know what to do with it or what it was, so I became a champion of alternative therapies when we had no conventional therapy to be alternative to, really. And when we got conventional therapy in 1986, I said, this isn't very good. So I wrote all the chapters in all the AIDS textbooks on complementary and alternative medicine. And then in 1992, somebody challenged me to study medicinal cannabis or marijuana in patients with the AIDS wasting syndrome. So I picked up the gauntlet and did that and learned a lot about plants, which gave me a strong appreciation for the power of plants as medicine, which ultimately took me to the Telluride Mushroom Festival in Telluride, Colorado, where I met Andrew Weil and heard about the 2-year fellowship in integrative medicine that you can do online from his program in integrative medicine at the University of Arizona. And I did that, and after completing that fellowship in 2004, I basically said, I'm done with HIV/AIDS. What I'd like to do now is integrative oncology, working with people living with and beyond cancer and helping them to integrate these other modalities into their conventional care. Can't really do that at San Francisco General, where, as I often say, for most of my patients, cancer is the least of their problems because they're homeless, psychotic, addicted, or undocumented, so I can't tell them to eat organic and do yoga. So I came to our Center for Integrative Medicine at the University of California, where I practice integrative oncology. What I tell my patients is that cancer is like a weed, and other people are taking care of their weed, and it's my job to work with the garden and make their soil as inhospitable as possible to growth and spread of the weed. So that's what I do.
Well, that's amazing, and it's rare to find a physician with a background like yours, so I think we should take about advantage of it and jump right in. I've had a chance to review the questions from both our panelists and some listeners who emailed their questions to Priya, and there are so many great ones. I'm only going to ask one question, I guess. And mine, having just returned from ASH down in New Orleans, the hematology meetings, and everything is buttoned up and documented, and there's trial after trial. And I guess my question is, so how do we, in an area where, you know, the drug companies aren't supporting the research and ongoing clinical trials, how does a patient know what's safe and what to take and how to use it?
Well, I think that's a very good question. And I just hung up from a patient who told me that everything I told her to take, when she went across the street to the cancer center, the pharmacist there said, "Are you kidding? You shouldn't take that. This will damage your liver. This will make you bleed. This will get you infected." So, you know, people get conflicting information. And I guess, you know, the real answer to that question is that we don't have all the evidence that we need in integrative medicine or integrative oncology. But Andrew Weil always says that the degree of evidence should be directly proportional to the potential for the intervention to do harm. So if I'm going to tell you, let's try this new chemotherapy drug, your hair is going to fall out, you're going to be vomiting for 4 days, and your bone marrow is going to be suppressed, you're going to say, show me the evidence that it works. If I'm going to tell you to get a massage twice a month or eat more blueberries, you know, how much damage can that do, and how much money do we need to spend and resources to produce evidence that, in fact, it is beneficial? So in answer to your question, the one way that I know best that integrative interventions are useful is because when I first opened my practice here, most of my patients came to me via word of mouth or through the internet, and now most of my patients are referred by my colleagues at the cancer center across the street, because I believe that my friends in conventional oncology perceive that the patients that I'm co-managing with them using integrative interventions maybe do better than patients who don't. But it's very difficult to test integrative oncology because it's a whole system, as we say, and our major funder of research in the United States is the National Institutes of Health, and they're very, very reductionist. So if I say, can I study an integrative oncology approach to see how patients do, they're going to say, no, what is that? I say, well, how about nutrition? What do you mean by that? How about fruits and vegetables? No, what does that mean? How about cruciferous vegetables? No, we can't fund that. How about sulforaphane? Yay, now they can fund the effect of sulforaphane, but in no way is that integrative oncology.
Sure, and it's both uplifting and sort of a downer at the same time.
Yeah. Welcome to my world.
Sure, and difficult when there's, like you said, when there's so many things involved, it's hard to isolate one thing and say this helps or that helps.
Well, for example, I just saw a patient today who told me that she saw a pain specialist And the pain specialist said she should not get acupuncture because that would spread her cancer. I mean, I couldn't believe that. I mean, acupuncture is something really that has been pretty well studied, and there's an increasing body of evidence that acupuncture is very beneficial for cancer patients in a number of different symptom managements, including pain. And to come up with, you know, such an archaic belief, sort of like people used to say that massage spreads cancer too, and you know, these things just are not correct.
Sure. Yeah, I can imagine. I can only imagine some of the roadblocks that you face. We have someone on our panel this evening from Canada. Let's get some questions in a Canadian perspective. Nancy?
Oh, hi. Thank you very much for having me on the show, Priya and Pat. And I'm sure that this will be very interesting, Dr. Abram, from your introduction. It just sounds fascinating. Should I ask my first question then?
Yes, please.
Yeah. Well, I am a multiple myeloma patient, and I have had a lot of chemotherapy treatments, you know, including Velcade, Revlimid, a stem cell transplant, and those put me into a remission. But in order, and I haven't taken any medications for almost 3 years, but I still have a low level. I have now a low level of monoclonal protein in my blood. Could I be taking some supplements to help with that? I have read that many patients take curcumin, turmeric, to try to keep the myeloma at bay. And not only do patients with active disease take curcumin, but also patients with MGUS, or smoldering myeloma, precursors to the disease. We do use a lot of turmeric in our home diet. You can buy it frozen and grate it into meals. Do you have any insights into the use of curcumin?
So curcumin is the active ingredient in turmeric, and I recommend for most of my patients turmeric. Again, this is something the patient I just spoke to on the phone was advised not to take by the pharmacist across the street because she said it would lead to increased bleeding, something I've never heard of. Turmeric, in looking at why the large population of India has such a low rate of both cancer and dementia, people have sort of focused on turmeric as being a very potent anti-inflammatory predominantly, and then possibly an anti-cancer spice. I have not heard anything about turmeric for MGUS or for myeloma in particular. The first I learned of turmeric having anti-cancer activity was at ASCO, the American Society of Clinical Oncology, in about 2006, when investigators from Ohio State reported on a mouse model of colon cancer that was very responsive to turmeric supplementation, in that these mice are genetically programmed to develop colon cancer, but when they were fed a diet enriched in turmeric, not only do they not develop colon cancer, but they survived longer than the control animals. So subsequently, most of the research and interest in turmeric has been for gastrointestinal malignancies, and it's also been looked at by one of my former fellows, Navneet Dhillon, when she was at MD Anderson in a small study in patients with pancreatic cancer, where it didn't seem to have that much effect against that very difficult malignancy. But I think it has greatest potential in the gastrointestinal malignancies, mainly because by itself it's not absorbed so well from the GI tract. So the expectation for it to have a systemic effect on something like myeloma or MGUS is maybe asking too much, and that's why I think it works best in the GI tract. Now, personally, for my arthritis, I take a curcumin preparation that has piperine, which is the active ingredient in black pepper, which increases the absorption of the turmeric 1,000-fold, which gives me a systemic level that provides anti-inflammatory effect for my arthritis. And I know there are a number of curcumin and turmeric preparations that are being formulated so that they're more absorbable, so that they may do things for other malignancies besides those in the colon.
Oh, thank you. Would you be kind enough to share the the product name of the turmeric or the curcumin?
Well, I don't know. Is that a good thing to do on the air? Am I allowed to do that?
I don't know.
Can we have some input?
I can't see how it would hurt.
I mean, why not?
Yeah, well, I mean, what I use is Swanson Curcumin Complex, and I order it online.
Okay. Thank you.
And, Doctor, could you spell piperine for us, please?
P-I-P-E-R-I-N-E. Black
okay.
pepper.
Well, that's very helpful.
Nancy is correct. My myeloma patients all over the world are starting to take curcumin, two grams, 3 grams, up to 8 grams a day.
On the basis of what evidence?
You get things on the internet.
Things get on the internet, and I've never
no,
seen...
No, no, this is, no, no. This is several studies, one of which I saw at ASH also.
Okay.
But like you said, it's hard to...
Yeah.
It's hard to translate how much to take. No one seems to know how much to take. MD
well,
Anderson,
because it's not absorbed.
A large
study on it.
Exactly.
Right. Sorry.
So, go ahead, Nancy. You had another question?
Yeah. Oh, well, I have quite a few questions, but I don't want to take up too much time, but I'll ask one more. This one was about calcium supplements. Or one of the side effects of having active myeloma can be bone destruction. Uh-huh. And we're not allowed to take calcium supplements if our calcium is higher than in the normal ranges, which happens sometimes. I was taking a calcium supplement, and then my calcium became abnormally high, so I had to stop taking the calcium supplement. But what would you recommend as the most important sources of calcium in the diet that I could be taking?
Well, I am personally not a fan of dairy, which is the most potent source of calcium. I advise my patients not to consume dairy products, but they are the richest source of calcium in the diet. After that, you get into green leafy vegetables, tofu, things like that. I personally drink, as long as we're doing product names, a German mineral water, Gerolsteiner, each glass giving me 10% of my daily calcium supplementation. Personally, I believe vitamin D supplementation is quite important as well. So just to make sure that you're getting your calcium, making sure you have an adequate vitamin D level. Although, again, as you say, myeloma patients can get into trouble with hypercalcemia or elevated blood calcium. So I'm not sure, how much vitamin D supplementation one wants in that situation, because that does increase absorption of calcium.
Well, speaking for myself and probably for most myeloma patients, we do get our blood tested quite frequently, at least every 3 months, I think most people do. So I think you can make adjustments. Right now I'm taking just a vitamin D supplement because I live in the north and we just don't get enough sunlight.
And your vitamin D should be taken as vitamin D needs to be taken as a gel bead or as a liquid. Many people take vitamin D preparations that are complex to calcium as a white powder. Vitamin D is fat soluble, so it's better to take it, again, as a gel bead or as a liquid as opposed to as a white powder.
Yes, that's what I have, a gel bead.
Yeah, I'm saying it for the benefit of other people in the audience.
Yes, of course. And thank you for the tip about the mineral water. That's really interesting.
That's a good one if you can find it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's probably available,
Yep.
Great, Nancy. Thanks.
Thanks, Pat.
Beverly, what do you have for the doctor?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that you are not a fan of dairy.
Uh-huh.
I'm a breast cancer survivor, and my tumor was very estrogen and progesterone positive, so I have done a lot of research into whether it's safe for breast cancer survivors to consume not only dairy but soy. So I'm asking a two-part question. The studies that I read are conflicting about whether dairy and soy are okay for breast cancer survivors or not. It depends on what you read and sometimes what day that you do the research. And so I'm wondering if you can kind of just share your opinion about Darien Soy, not only just for breast cancer survivors, but also just the general public, and maybe why you're not a fan of Darien, because I know why I'm not, but I think the listeners might like to hear that.
Okay, well, let's do dairy first. There is no other animal that drinks another species' milk, but no other animal drives a car or goes to college, so that's not a good argument. But no animal drinks milk after they've been weaned. And by the age of 3 or 4, we actually all lose the ability to digest the sugars and the proteins in dairy. We make a big deal about fat, no fat, low fat, 2%. It's not the fat, and if you want a dairy product, probably butter might be one of the better ones. We talk about lactose intolerance as if it's a disease or a disorder, when in fact it's the norm. And the ability to digest lactose is a genetic mutation on the second chromosome, which found mainly in Scandinavians who needed to digest reindeer milk in times of freeze. Otherwise, most of the world's people are all lactose intolerant, and we don't know it until we stop. So then people say, well, what about yogurt? Because in yogurt and kefir, the proteins and the sugars have been altered by the fermentation. So again, butter or yogurt or kefir, if somebody needs a dairy product, is probably best. However, we know that breast cancer is exacerbated or perhaps promoted by saturated fats, and dairy is a saturated fat. In addition, cows, to be able to produce dairy continuously, are given bovine growth hormone, which I'm told, although I've been challenged on this, when we see that in our body, it promotes insulin-like growth factor. Insulin-like growth factor promotes inflammation and also causes cancer cells to divide. In fact, a new way of treating cancer is looking at blocking the insulin-like growth factor number 1 receptor, and that's been looked at in women with estrogen receptor-positive breast cancer. So I am not a fan of dairy for patients with cancer or without cancer. Soy gets a bad rep right now because of GMO, and I don't really follow the GMO story, so I'm not going to go there. But we know from epidemiologic studies that Asians living in Asia, eating an Asian diet, have a lower risk of breast and prostate cancer. And it's felt that it's soy, particularly possibly during adolescence, which provides that risk, or it lowers that risk of those hormone-driven cancers. Because soy is a plant estrogen or phytoestrogen, there has been some fear that women, particularly with estrogen receptor-positive breast cancer, should avoid soy products. However, Kaiser Permanente did a large study in Northern California where they asked women with breast cancer, particularly about their consumption of soy, and found that women with estrogen receptor-positive breast cancer who ate the equivalent of Asian amounts of soy, that is a portion a day of whole soy foods, actually had decreased risk of recurrence of their breast cancer, even if they were on tamoxifen, which previously we feared would compete with soy for its selective estrogen receptor modulation. This study was confirmed by also a large study in Shanghai. So I'm an author of a paper that suggests that oncologists do not have to have their patients with breast cancer fear soy at all. However, when I advise people about soy, I suggest that they eat whole soy foods like soybeans, soy milk, tofu, tempeh, and miso, and not soy turkey, soy cheese, and soy hot dogs, because those are just heavily processed foods. So I'm pro-soy and anti-dairy.
Okay. How do you feel about almond milk? I'm just going to throw
almond
that in there.
Almond milk is fine. That's a great alternative to a glass of cow. Almond, that's hemp, cashew, soy, and rice. All very good. As long as they don't have added sugar. Because
right.
my three no's are dairy, sugar, and red meat.
Okay. That's great information. Thank you so much for answering my first question.
Sure.
Thanks, Beverly. Shweta, I see you've got a great question.
Hi, everyone. Yeah, thanks, Pat. and thanks for having me on the show today. And I just heard Dr. Abraham saying that no-no for him is dairy, sugar, and red meat. So my question here relates to sugar in cancer patients. And being a nutritionist, this is important to me because most of the time the cancer patients are on chemotherapy and they lose appetite, they lose taste, and they have to deal with symptoms of nausea, vomiting, and GI upset. So they're not able to eat so much. So being a nutritionist, our job is to at least fulfill their minimum calorie requirement. So is it a good idea to feed or increase the calorie content of a cancer patient's diet by adding sugar or fat to it? Mainly, my question is regarding sugar here.
Yeah, no.
Okay.
I mean, I quote all the time the guidelines from the World Cancer Research Fund, American Institute for Cancer Research. Every 10 years, they come up with their compendium of guidelines to reduce the risk of cancer, 10 guidelines. And number 10 says, for cancer survivors, follow the 9 guidelines above. Number 1 is to be as lean as possible without being underweight. Number 2 is to be physically active for 30 minutes each day. Number 3 is the first that says anything about food, and it simply says avoid sugary drinks. So I was at the microphone at the meeting in 2007 when they unveiled that, and I said, there are sugary drinks and there are sugary drinks. You can drink a cola beverage or a fruit punch, which is probably glucose and high fructose corn syrup, or you can squeeze 3 oranges in the morning. And the response from the podium was, energetically, they're all the same. So if you eat an orange, as you know, the fiber slows down the absorption of the glucose into the bloodstream. If you squeeze the sugar away from the fiber, it's like drinking a cola beverage. And why is that bad? When the body sees that surge of sugar, it squirts out insulin, an insulin-like growth factor, both of which promote inflammation and cause cancer cells to divide. So there are many other things that patients can eat besides sugar. I mean, when my colleagues across the street in the cancer center started to ask me, why do you tell all of our patients that cancer loves sugar? I say, what is a PET scan? PET CT scans are how we stage cancer now. We inject people with radio-labeled glucose, and where does it go? To the tumor, because cancer needs sugar for energy. It doesn't use oxygen. So I have a patient that I just met 3 weeks ago who's now getting chemotherapy across the street, and she said to me, do you know what they serve in the infusion center? It's all garbage. I said, yes, I've been trying to correct this for the last 7 years, but nobody listens to me. Yeah, and it saddens me when I see my patients at San Francisco General Hospital with cancer on their hospital trays. They have a can of a toxic supplement because, you know, this is what we give them. It's 4 different types of sugar.
Okay, yeah, that's interesting to know that PET CT scan use glucose infusions. Is there any other way to scan it?
Well, I mean, no, I'm not worried about that. I'm just saying that we're taking advantage of cancer's affinity for sugar by using it as a method to stage and find cancer. That doesn't worry me as much as about patients eating refined carbohydrates.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you mentioned that oranges would be better as compared to having just plain glucose drinks. So what about the patients who are on a low-residue or low-fiber diet?
That's always a problem for me because, you know, the diet that I recommend to my cancer patients is organic, plant-based, antioxidant-rich, anti-inflammatory whole foods. So when it comes to those patients with issues in their GI tract where they have to be on low-residue diets, then I have to engage a nutritionist because I'm not so good at that.
Okay. Yeah, that answers my question. I have a couple more questions. Can I ask it right now, Pat, or later?
No, go ahead. Absolutely.
Okay. So on that note that you mentioned about antioxidants, I had a question about that. That there is a concern that some of the antioxidant supplements may interfere with cancer-killing treatments. Is that true? And can you just explain a little bit more detail about it?
Yeah. So oxygen, as you know, Liz, is as two molecules linked together. That's how we breathe and that's how we live. But when those oxygen molecules separate, they become free radicals, mm-hmm. or so-called reactive oxygen species, which knock into our DNA doing damage, leading to aging or cancer. Antioxidants mm-hmm. take those free radicals out of circulation so they don't do damage to DNA. Now, it turns out that radiation therapy works by creating free radicals of oxygen to damage the cancer cell DNA. So some okay. chemotherapy drugs also work as well by generating free radicals of oxygen to do damage to the cancer cell's DNA. So there's a theoretical concern that taking antioxidant supplements while you're getting radiation or some of those chemotherapeutic agents may actually diminish the effectiveness of the radiation and chemotherapy. And that would be a shame because those are can be sort of toxic and you don't want to go through it and not get the benefit. Has there been any research that's proven that? The main study that's quoted is actually a study in patients with head and neck cancer who were receiving vitamin E during radiation. And that study showed that although vitamin E supplementation during radiation led to decreased toxicity of the radiation, it also apparently led to increased recurrences and shorter survival in the patients who were randomly assigned to get active vitamin E compared to placebo. That was one study, but it certainly has influenced the radiation oncology world to tell their patients no antioxidant supplements while they're getting radiation therapy. And again, most conservative oncologists have extrapolated further and say no antioxidant supplements while you're getting any cancer treatment. Whether or not that's true is unclear. Keith Block, who edits Integrative Cancer Therapies, one of the main journals in integrative oncology, did a meta-analysis of about 18 studies of antioxidants and found no evidence that they shorten survival. Now, some of the radiation oncologists okay. even go so far as to tell patients not to eat blueberries or only eat white food while they're getting radiation. I think that's a bit extreme. I don't think that antioxidant-rich foods are going to interfere. When it comes down to that beam of radiation versus the blueberry, who do you think wins? So I think it's fine to eat an antioxidant-rich diet during chemotherapy and radiation, but I do err on the side of caution and recommend people not take antioxidant supplements to a great degree when they're receiving chemo, especially if the goal of chemotherapy is cure or if it's given in an adjuvant setting. If the goal of chemotherapy is just palliation and we're not really going to cure the patient, then maybe if they can decrease side effects, then maybe that's a time when some antioxidants might be warranted.
Oh, okay, yeah, that answers my question, Dr. Aram. Thanks a lot for answering my question.
Yep, my pleasure.
All right, we have a long list of questions from listeners, but as I read through these, I'm struck by how similar they all are. We have a lot of prostate cancer listeners, number one. So rather than go, case study by case study, and there's some redundancy here, doctor, any specific thoughts about what a prostate cancer survivor should be eating?
Should be eating?
Eating?
Yes.
Supplementing?
Yeah. So sure. Prostate cancer survivors, first of all, benefit from not being obese and not having a body mass index greater than 25. So if they do, then I would recommend that they go on a reduction diet. But again, the diet that I recommend for everybody is organic, plant-based, antioxidant-rich, anti-inflammatory whole foods. For prostate cancer, of course, lycopene, or the active ingredient in tomatoes, is recommended because it has been shown to be beneficial. Lycopene needs to be oil extracted, so tomato paste or tomato sauce is the best source as opposed to eating raw tomatoes. Watermelon and pink grapefruit also have lycopene. I also favor soy for prostate cancer patients, and deep cold water fish that are rich in omega-3 fatty acids. There is just a bit of controversy about omega-3 fatty acids may increase the risk of prostate cancer. I think that's a poorly done study. I think salmon, black cod, albacore tuna, herring, mackerel, and sardines are all good fish, rich in omega-3s, and should be consumed by prostate cancer patients who, since they are not going to eat that every day, should probably take an omega-3 fatty acid supplement. Pomegranate is also something that has been shown to slow PSA rises. And there was a recommendation that 8 ounces of pomegranate juice should be consumed. Now, here's again another one of those situations where I'm concerned about the amount of sugar in pomegranate juice without the fiber that's associated with eating a pomegranate. So that's one time where I prefer that my patients actually might take one of those pomegranate capsules as opposed to drinking that much sugar. Green tea, I'm just on my 5th cup of the day, is something I recommend for most of my cancer patients, but it particularly has been shown to be of benefit in men with prostate cancer. So green tea is another one of those. As far as supplements, again, I measure all of my patients' 25-hydroxy vitamin D levels to make sure that their vitamin D is normal. Low vitamin D has been associated with increased risk of a number of cancers, including breast, prostate, colon, and pancreatic. And in some of those cancers, it's been demonstrated that patients with low vitamin D levels have outcomes that are not as good as patients whose vitamin D levels have been normalized. So I do recommend vitamin D supplementation. Omega-3s, as I said. Calcium is interesting because calcium and prostate cancer is a little controversial. There is some suggestion that calcium may increase the risk of prostate cancer. Some people think that that's dairy products increasing the risk of prostate cancer and not calcium per se. However, in Singapore, where they don't consume a lot of dairy because they're lactose intolerant, it was demonstrated that calcium content of vegetable intake was associated with a greater risk of prostate cancer. So in general, for most of my patients over the age of 50, I do recommend a calcium magnesium supplement. However, some of the men with prostate cancer, I might leave that out. I'm also a big fan, as I mentioned, of mushrooms and medicinal mushrooms. So generally, I recommend some sort of a mushroom blend to most of my patients. There's another or some evidence that turmeric, again, may be useful in prostate cancer patients. And one particular proprietary supplement called Zyflamend, which is a 10-botanical COX-2 inhibitor, has been demonstrated to reverse early prostate intraepithelial neoplasia. So that's something I also find that I recommend to men with prostate cancer. Also, physical activity is very important. You know, we tend to think in our Western pharmaceutically dominated paradigm that if you take something and swallow it with a glass of water, that's easier than making a lifestyle change. And I know it's very difficult to implement 30 to 60 minutes of physical activity daily into our busy schedules, but that is something that has a very positive impact in breast, prostate, colon, a number of other malignancies.
Thank you, Doctor. I've got a question here about mistletoe supplement. I've never even heard of that. Can you tell us anything about
yes.
that?
Yes, I do. Very popular in Europe, anthroposophic medicine. Actually, if I can just plug my book for a second, Andrew Weil and I edited the book Integrative Oncology by Oxford University Press, and we have a whole chapter on anthroposophic medicine and mistletoe. And I have a disclaimer in the foreword that just because we include things in the book doesn't mean that we support them. And mistletoe, because it is probably the most widely used complementary or alternative therapy for cancer in Germanic-speaking countries, is something we felt we needed to include. Actually, I'm also one of the editors of the National Cancer Institute Physician Data Query Complementary and Alternative Medicine website. That's NCIPDQCAM. And if you Google NCIPDQCAM mistletoe, you'll see our document on mistletoe, which has been undergoing some revisions as we look at it more carefully. The studies that were done in Germany were conducted in a very unusual fashion, where they looked at 11,000 patients with cancer and sort of collected those 5 or 10 years down the line and tried to see if they were taking mistletoe. And if they were, then they matched them to other patients in the cohort who were not yet dead and compared their outcomes of the mistletoe people to the non-mistletoe people, and got very spectacular outcomes that were, in my opinion, totally unbelievable. So that's sort of what they call a retrospective study, doesn't replace a prospective randomized placebo-controlled trial. And in studies of mistletoe that have been conducted in the more rigorous Western fashion, prospective randomized placebo-controlled, there may be some suggestion that mistletoe decreases some symptoms of cancer or its treatment and maybe improves quality of life, but I haven't been impressed that it does anything for overall survival, which in my opinion is the most important outcome. So I am not a huge believer in mistletoe. It needs to also be injected subcutaneously, and it needs to be imported sort of in our country. That's against it's importing something that's not available in this country. So I wouldn't waste my energy, time, and money on it personally.
Okay. Well, that helps. Panelists, or Priya, do we have any, has anyone called in with questions?
Listeners, if you have a question for our panel, you may please press 1 on your keypads and we can bring you live on air to ask your question. Yeah, we have a caller online. Now, Pat, I'll just bring them online. Person calling in from 858-204-6956. Please ask your question.
Hi, it's Lizzie, and I am so sorry. I joined a few minutes late. And maybe you covered this in the first, 5 or 10 minutes that I missed. But why such a hesitation among most oncologists about talking about nutrition and how nutrition can help either beat cancer, treat cancer, help people stay well? I specifically, when I was diagnosed with myeloma, went in and spoke with my oncology center's nutritional department. And I said, I've been reading lots of books. I think I should be eating garlic and not eating sugar. And I went through this whole list. Flat out, they said, that really doesn't matter. You know, if you want to have chocolate cake, eat the chocolate cake. Just eat lots of healthy food. And I thought, but sugar stimulates cancer. And I brought up the PET scan, and they said, not while you're in treatment. No. And then they handed me an article saying that really sugar didn't have any effect on cancer. And I thought, why the hesitation? I'm actually kind of getting a little upset now that I'm thinking about it. But why? Do you think?
Well, I think, it's a very good question. First of all, oncologists are very demanding of the evidence. I mean, of all the evidence-based specialties, because we use such toxic drugs, we want evidence from randomized, placebo-controlled clinical trials. Nutritional evidence is really quite difficult to come by, and we have to generally utilize epidemiologic studies, because we can't randomize 25,000 people over here to drink green tea and eat tofu 3 times a day versus 25,000 people over there to drink green tea placebo and eat tofu placebo 3 times a day. So the studies can't be done. And, oncology has become targeted therapies, nanotechnology, genomics. It's very high tech. Nutrition is like motherhood and apple pie. It's very basic, and you know, we've oncologists feel we've moved beyond that. Plus, we don't learn about nutrition in medical school. I mean, yesterday I taught third-year medical students about nutrition and health and wellness. I mean, if we're going to try to have affordable medical care in our country, we need to be a health care system, not a disease management system. And so you look at the average oncologist, they have to be so specialized today. They can't be a GI oncologist. They have to be pancreatic or colon or liver. You know, it's the breast group. Everybody is in their own specialty silo, and that's what they know. So you can't expect any of those people to really be up to date on nutrition. So it's much easier to do the default and say it doesn't really matter what you eat. Eat whatever you want, rather than say, I don't know.
Up to us. I guess it's
does that help, Lizzie? Then.
Yes. So it does. So I guess then it's just up to us to, you know, do our own research.
Questions.
And,
yeah.
You know, my whole thing was I didn't know who to ask. So I just thought, well, you know, I'll just cut out sugar anyway. It certainly can't hurt. And I kind of don't believe what they're saying anyway. I do think it matters, you know, what we put into our body. The other thing that I see, I have chemo brain, sorry, still. The other thing I spoke about or asked about my treating physician was, what about green tea? And they said, no green tea. And that is the first I've heard of any of that.
Because
Lizzie, I believe that's a Velcade interaction.
Yeah, but that study published in Blood, there's no humanly possible way that you could achieve that level of ECGC by drinking green tea. So that is another one of those bogus fears. Yeah, there's no way that you could achieve that blood level in a human being drinking green tea.
So in your opinion, green tea is, every study says, is so anti-cancer. Do you believe that even if I'm taking Velcade, I'm on another one-year maintenance plan, would you say that would be
safe?
Well,
I'm not
going to,
you know, I don't do individual patient consultations from audiences personally, so I don't know enough about your story, but, you know, you can discuss what I just told you with your oncologist and see how they feel about it. I think that's the safer thing to do, not ask me. Yeah, I don't know you. I don't know you at all.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, but you mentioned that, you know, please look and to see if that level of green tea, the micromoles that were given in test tubes, you know, or to mice, is an achievable blood level in humans drinking green tea, and it's not.
Okay,
but that gets published in Blood, you know, the most prestigious journal, because it's a negative study.
Sounds like we should all be reading Integrative Oncology, Doctor.
Well, there's a lot of good books out there, but, you know, that's the one I wrote. So.
That'd be a good place to start. But your point about green tea, can't you apply that to most any a supplement? I mean, it's a jump, it's a stretch, right, from what happens in your gut to what actually happens in the bloodstream and then affects the cancer cell?
No, I'm not sure I understand what you mean.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to be the one to argue with you. I think I pretty much agree with everything you're saying, but, you know, for example, on the sugar, nutritionists would argue that just about any carbohydrate is sugar, and your body can't tell the difference between.
No, but it's the rapidity with which it becomes sugar in your bloodstream, which stimulates insulin-like growth factor. We know that diabetics have more cancer, and diabetics with cancer who are treated with insulin don't do as well as diabetics with cancer who are not treated with insulin. And interestingly, we now know that metformin actually seems to decrease the risk of cancer, and diabetics with cancer on metformin, an oral hypoglycemic agent, which actually is derived from the French lilac, actually have better outcomes than diabetics with cancer not on metformin. So it's all about, you know, insulin and insulin-like growth factor. And as I mentioned earlier, blockade of insulin-like growth factor is becoming a new strategy for treating cancer. So it's the rate at which these, everything ultimately becomes sugar. And that's what I tell people when I'm advising them about no sugar, that when you buy a food that's packaged in the nutrition facts box in our country, it's okay to have sugars in the nutrition facts box because that's what fuels our brain. Where I don't want to see sugar or any nickname for sugar is in the ingredients list. Here's a bar I'm holding in my hand that a patient gave me. She said, I only eat healthy food. The first ingredient is brown rice syrup, followed by soy protein isolate, whatever that is, followed by evaporated cane juice crystals, followed by crystalline fructose. So that's three out of the first four ingredients are nicknames for sugar. That's where I don't want sugar, because those all become, you know, a stimulation to our pancreas to secrete insulin, insulin-like growth factor, which promote inflammation and cause cancer cells to divide.
I appreciate the specific way that you're addressing these issues. It's very helpful, and again, it's something that you don't normally find. Panelists, does anyone have any follow-ups for the good doctor?
Dr. Abrams, this is Beverly McKee again. I would like to get your thoughts on the mind-body connection. I'm a mental health therapist, and I'm a strong believer in the mind-body connection. I believe you do some work with that.
Sure.
Can you tell us how do you implement that mind-body work, that mind-body treatment with your patients?
Yeah, well, so I tell patients that stress is not a good thing for cancer. I start my interview asking my patients, tell me your story. And they often say, what story, or where do I start, or which one, or they hand me a sheaf of papers and say, here it is. I said, no, I want to hear your story. And many of my patients develop a story suggesting that stress caused their cancer. I don't think stress in and of itself causes cancer, but we know that stress is not good for cancer. Stress is adrenaline or epinephrine, which kills our lymphocytes, the building block cells of our immune system, and stress is cortisol, which is a steroid hormone, which is an immune suppressant. So decreasing stress is a good thing. And in fact, they've done studies in mice who had breast cancer, metastatic. And one group of mice were confined to a small space for 3 hours a day, whereas the other group ran free. And the confined group, at the end of the study, the stress group, their primary breast cancers were the same size as the control group, but they had increased size and number of metastatic lesions. So mice are not people. They found in women with ovarian cancer who lack support, social support, and who have a higher level of distress, that their tumors actually have more VEGF, or vascular epithelial growth factor, which allows them to become more aggressive. Similar finding with increased VEGF and depression has been found in patients with head and neck cancer. So these are some of the first evidences that stress or emotional state may influence the aggressiveness of a tumor. And so for me, after nutrition, physical activity, supplements, and Chinese medicine, then I want stress reduction to be a key part of the regimen that we develop in integrative oncology. And I myself don't meditate. I do yoga, and I try to recommend yoga. I recommend exercise, physical activity, I think is good for stress. I give my patients a catalog of guided imagery, CD-ROMs, because I think guided imagery is a good thing. I have biofeedback here that I can refer patients to, and we have an 8-week mindfulness-based stress reduction program as well that some patients find quite useful. On a physical medicine aspect, I think massage is a very good way to reduce stress as well. So I have those armamentarium, or in my armamentarium, for working with patients to try to decrease stress, because I think that's quite critical. We know how much the mind impacts the body and vice versa. I mean, it's all the same container. If you're sitting in a traffic jam and you need to get someplace, you can get yourself stressed to the point where your neck is stiff, your blood pressure's up, you feel your heart beating, you're sweating, or you could just try to, you know, let go and realize that the meeting will happen when you get there.
I completely agree. Thank you for sharing that with me.
Mm-hmm. My pleasure.
Yeah, we have 5 more minutes, and we have a few callers too. I'll try to bring them online on air quickly. The person calling in from 760-439, please ask your question.
I have recurrent prostate cancer, and the PSA came back after prostatectomy. And when it got up to 0.2, I got really concerned about it. And I emailed my dad's old oncologist, Stephen Strum, and he suggested the B-DIM supplement made by BioResponse. And I started taking that stuff, and my PSA stopped there at 0.2, went down a little bit, and then back up to 0.2, and it's been like 11 months. And that's been the most effective supplement I've used. Before that, it was doubling every 5 months. So,
doubling to anything less than 2, I'm not that concerned about personally. But so DIM is one of those components of cruciferous vegetables. It's diindolmethylamine or whatever. Changes your estrogen from the type that fuels estrogen receptor positive cancers to the type that doesn't. I haven't heard of men taking DIM, and one of my concerns really is taking these isolated chemicals from foods and concentrating them to levels that we don't understand what they're going to do. For example, Paracelsus was an alchemist who spanned alchemy and medicine in the Renaissance, who said there's poison in everything. The difference between a remedy and a poison is the dose. Resveratrol is a very popular supplement as well. Resveratrol is what's found in grapes and red wine, and it's felt to be an appetite suppressant and perhaps a life extender. However, 1 gram of resveratrol is equal to the amount of resveratrol in 667 bottles of red wine. I prefer for my patients to drink green tea, because green tea extract taken on an empty stomach can damage the liver. I don't know what DIM does, or indole-3-carbinol, which is another cruciferous vegetable ingredient, when taken at that high concentration for long periods of time. So I, as an oncologist, tend to err on the side of caution. And I don't think 0.2 is a very elevated PSA to begin with, so I wouldn't expect it to be jumping out of control. So you don't have.
Yeah, well, it would be at 0.8 right now if I hadn't been taking it. So, that's some assumption.
I don't know how you know that. I don't know where.
Because it was doubling every 4 months.
Right.
It's been 10 months.
The body is not quite that predictable. It's not.
Well, it's been predictable for about 2.5 years so far.
Okay.
So, yeah. Yeah, anyway, bioresponse.com is the people that make it. And it's made for better absorption, so you actually only have to take a small amount. It's only 25% DIM, so each 150 milligram only has 37 milligrams of DIM. And one a day actually was enough to slow it down at first. I'm up to 4 now, but one a day did work for me for several months.
Uh-huh.
Well, I'm glad something's helping. That's
yeah.
Great.
Thank you, Alan. We have just one more caller. I'll try to bring him on before we wrap up today's show. Caller calling in from 415-531. Please ask your question.
Thank you. I just wanted some clarification about the green tea and Velcade, because it was left, I believe, that Lizzie what had a particular individual question, but in fact, many of us have been told that when we're on Velcade, no green tea. So are you saying that green tea with Velcade is okay?
I told you what I know, that the study that your hematologist oncologist is reporting was in blood, and it was a study that was not done in humans. It's in the test tube, and it's in animals. And the amount of green tea that was used, the concentration, is not a concentration that can be achieved by drinking green tea.
Okay, thank you.
That's all I can say.
Thank you, Doctor. Just one last question. Could you talk a little bit about cannabis oil as a cure? That's the last question that came in from one of our listeners.
Oh, well, that's an hour-long program. I'm sorry.
The person wants to know if it is going to be beneficial.
Cannabis oil is not a cure for cancer. You know, some patients benefit from taking it with the symptom management, and perhaps it has some anti-cancer activity. It needs to be studied. There's a lot of anecdote out there. The plural of anecdote is not evidence.
Thank you so much, Dr. Abrams. Pat, Nancy, Beverly, and Shweta, thanks a lot. That was a great discussion. I think we shared a lot of information. I hope the audience benefited too. We look forward to having all of you join us for our next Cure Panel Talk Show, which is on January 23rd at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. And we're discussing Yoga Nidra for PTSD and Mental Health with Dr. Richard Miller, Founder Director of IRIS. Please visit curepanel.carefeed.net for registering for upcoming shows, or mail me, priya@trilex.com, for registering for the event. The broadcast link for today's show will be sent via email to all participants. Thank you so much.